Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the retirement of the media baron who changed American politics by creating a Soviet-style propaganda arm for the Republican Party, Fox News, which unleashed junkyard dogs posing as journalists to ramp up partisan friction and polarize our politics to the point of dysfunction and paralysis. Award-winning investigative journalist Carl Grossman, professor of journalism at the State University of New York, joins us to discuss Rupert Murdoch's handover of his media empire to his son James, who previously oversaw his father's newspapers and TV network in Britain and was engulfed in the phone hacking scandal that led to a parliamentary inquiry, which prompted his transfer to the company's headquarters in New York. Then we'll look into the apparent Republican plans to finish off Obama's signature achievement, the Affordable Care Act, if the Supreme Court rules against it and takes away health care insurance for 6.4 million Americans who now have it, many for the first time. Sarah Leake, a senior analyst in health policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the co-author of their new report, New Republican Proposal Would Leave Millions Uninsured or Underinsured, joins us to discuss how the Republicans will extend temporary help to the immediate victims of the ruling in return for making sure there are many millions more who will have no health coverage in the future. Then finally, we will speak with Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He is the co-author of a new strategic analysis, Fiscal Austerity, Dollar Appreciation, and Maldistribution Will Derail the U.S. Economy. And we will discuss the report and how destructive political ideology is crippling recovery and undermining an otherwise healthy economy. And joining us now is Carl Grossman, who has specialized in doing investigative reporting in a variety of media for more than 40 years and is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York's College of Old Westbury. He's the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and has received the George Polk, James Aronson, and John Peter Zenger Awards for his journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Grossman.
A pleasure to be with you.
And Carl, what do you make of Rupert Murdoch handing the top job at his family company, 21st Century Fox, over to his son, James, and also elevating the other son, the older son, Lachlan? It's not being totally greeted on Wall Street because the stock went down a bit today. I think it finally recovered. So what do you make of this change?
Well, Murdoch has always, this goes way back to the beginning. He inherited, there was a newspaper in Australia called the Adelaide News after his father died, his father, Sir Keith Murdoch. This sort of family lineage, sort of the North Korean model, continues in the Murdoch Empire. The issue here, however, is that Murdoch is not really out. I mean, that would be wonderful news. I think it's good news that this may signal that he's heading out. Now he's in his 80s, 83, but he'll stay on as executive chairman of 20th Century Fox, which runs not just the movie studio in your backyard, but runs other broadcasting entities, including the, as you noted, the odious Fox News Channel, this Roger Ailes-directed propaganda arm for the Republican Party. He is not stepping down at all. He's not leaving at all News Corp, which owns, as many newspapers in Australia. From that paper in Adelaide, now it's 150 newspapers that Murdoch owns in Australia, including the most prominent paper in the country, The Australian. But beyond that, Murdoch owns here in New York, my town, the New York Post, which when I was a kid was the people's newspaper in New York City. It sure isn't anymore. It's a disgrace. He owns, and again, this is the News Corp, which he's going to be sticking with, at least for the time being, the most eminent, it had been the most eminent newspaper in the English-speaking world, the Times of London. And furthermore, he has purchased, and he'll continue to control it, the Wall Street Journal. His plan for the Wall Street Journal has been to use it to take on the New York Times. So Murdoch is seemingly giving up some control to his various sons, but he's still sticking with an important element of his huge empire. It's the third biggest media empire in the country,
if not the world, I would think, right?
Well, I'd say it's the largest. I mean, you look at the whole the array of it. We've really seen nothing like it. I mean, Murdoch has been compared to William Randolph Hearst, and a movie was made, speaking of Hollywood and 20th Century Fox, by Orson Welles about William Randolph Hearst, Citizen Kane. And as William Shawcross wrote in his biography of Murdoch, Murdoch has really fashioned himself and has become an international Citizen Kane with, and these are Shawcross's words, with influence beyond imagining.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Grossman, who specializes in doing investigative reporting in a variety of media for more than 40 years and is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York's College at Old Westbury. He's the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and has received the George Polk, James Aronson, and John Peter Zenger Awards for his journalism. But clearly there is friction between the family and the professionals that Rupert Murdoch has hired to run 20th Century Fox. He seems to be more interested in the newspapers than anything else. But the people that he's hired, like Peter Chernin and his successor, Chase Carey, were given a certain amount of autonomy. But I think in the case of Chernin, he quit because he knew that he was never going to run the company. And apparently Carey's going to stay on for a little bit. But these powerful executives always understood a part of their job was keeping Murdoch at arm's length and having him run his and empires. But they were never very happy about the kids. And the kids have fought amongst themselves a lot, too.
Oh, they have. And, you know, of course, a lot of this, how should I put it, the changes, the split actually of the News Corporation into two entities, 20th Century Fox and News Corp, came after this enormous hacking scandal in the United Kingdom, which resulted in the end of, right in the middle of it, one of the News of the World, one of Murdoch's biggest properties. He had to close that. He was really, I mean, it looked for a while that Murdoch, because as in the United States, in the United Kingdom, to be in broadcasting, one is supposed to have levels of honesty and integrity. And the fact that this element of his vast empire, clearly, I mean, they were hacking all kind of people from the public officials to various victims of crime, bribery was involved, and so forth. In any case, what Murdoch did running scared was to divide his empire in two. One, a publishing, more or less, HarperCollins is also a huge publishing entity owned by Murdoch, still is, along with the newspapers and so forth, and the other more into video, film, a television. And James, and this is very important, he was dethroned. He was pushed out as a result of the scandal. in the United Kingdom, and at that point they brought in some non-family people to be executives. Now the talk is today, the reporting is today that the empire will be back in the hands of Murdoch children. And there's not only friction, I mean, this has been reported through the years, between the various sons, and there's a daughter involved too, but also Roger Ailes does not get along with James Murdoch, it said. And some of the reports today indicated that, I mean, Fox News Channel, as deplorable, as odious, as a travesty on journalism is, It pulls in $2 billion a year. I mean, an enormous amount of money. And the reporting today was that Ailes will not be reporting to James Murdoch, even though James would be the CEO of 20th Century Fox, but would remain reporting to his buddy Rupert. So this may be an indication that ultimately Rupert will just pass through the media world and divest with his sons, but I think that will be in the future. It is not now.
And of course, one of the people in the middle of the hacking scandal, Rebecca Brooks, who was one of his tabloid editors and something of a daughter to Murdoch, she's back now. She's out of prison and back running a Murdoch company. But when you say the hacking scandal was involved crime, I mean, there's nothing more despicable than what they did. They deleted messages from the phone of a young girl who was kidnapped, raped, and murdered. And they, in doing so, they gave the parents the false hope because they were able to, you know, keep leaving messages on the phone. I don't think you can get much more despicable than that. And they created a kind of culture. It was very clear in those hearings at the British Parliament that this is a really tawdry, nasty bunch of people and a corporate culture that's pretty despicable. But they really escaped, and Murdoch acted like a doddering old man, and his son did everything he could to defend the father, and nobody got blamed, and they got off, essentially, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. That for a while there, as I say, in 2011, it looked like he'd be in big trouble. But somehow, I mean, he's always been so cozy to power, which is part of the, I've been a journalist all my life. And we journalists are supposed to be watchdogs. Monitors, whisper. I mean, the whole system here in this country, checks and balances between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, and a media and a press, as it was called way back then, which would take on the whole kit and caboodle, would challenge power. Murdoch has been intimate with power, and certainly those that he fancies. He got into, he inherited this paper from his father, but the thing with Murdoch is that he wanted to use the press, he wanted to use the media, and he wanted to do it on an international scale to promote his arch right wing political view. He became a U.S. citizen, for example, in 1985. He gave up the Australian citizenship because for part of our Federal Communications Act is that you must be a U.S. citizen to have a controlling interest in a television station, radio station in the United States. And he was going, and this is in the 80s, he was going to base this global media empire that he was building here in the United States. But his goal, his plan, his scheme was to use this media empire to propagandize, to I mean, for this arch conservative philosophy, if you want to call it a philosophy, that he has, and what he's done along the way. I mean, beyond the hacking, when I said when I was a kid growing up in New York, the New York Post is the oldest continually published daily in the United States. Alexander Hamilton began it in the early 19th century, and there I was a kid in the 1950s, and James Wexler and Dorothy Schiff and Max Lerner, wonderful liberal folk, and the paper represented, as I say, it represented the voice of the people of New York City. If you pick up the New York Post now, or if don't pick it up, don't pay the money for it, look at it online. It's like it makes the National Enquirer seem respectable. It's outrageous. And if I was a Brit, to see what I mean, the Times of London was always a little bit for an upper class kind of the Times of London was what the Times of London was, but these days, what Murdoch has done to the Times of London is horrendous for folks who enjoyed that respectable newspaper for so many years.
Well, obviously, you mentioned the role of journalism. As H.L. Mencken said, the job of journalists is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And Murdoch has certainly turned that on its head. But at least he is a personality, and he's clearly also a political kingmaker. He decides who becomes prime minister in Australia, and he also does the same in the UK. There was an audio tape intercepted of an emissary of Roger Hales trying to get David Petraeus to run for president against Obama so they could own the presidency here in the United States. So there's no question about their political ambitions. But it seems that these sons, James, who's taking over, and Lachlan, his older brother, who quit the company and is now back, who's, waiting in the wings, and the daughter, who Elizabeth, who quit again, angry at her brother James, she'll probably be back in the mix as well. I don't know much about them, but I don't think they have anything like the personality of their father. I think, as far as I can tell, they're just sort of vacuous yuppies.
Yeah, well, that's the good news about this. Again, it being an indication of Murdoch being ultimately, I don't know how many years it'll take. He may live to 110, but he probably won't. But being probably within a decade on his way totally out, and the children, I mean, who could be as bad in terms of journalistic integrity and honesty? And Murdoch, to me, if listeners want to read a piece that I wrote, have it right in front of me here, Murdoch Media Empire, A Journalistic Travesty, just put my name, Carl Grossman, Carl with a K, Grossman, Huffington Post, 2011. You can read a very elaborate piece that I wrote about Rupert Murdoch. And so the children can't be, he has been so bad, the children can't be as bad as Rupert Murdoch, I think. But it'll take time before he's completely out of the picture, Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Carl Grossman.
A pleasure.
And I've been speaking with Carl Grossman, who has specialized in doing investigative reporting in a variety of media for more than 40 years and is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York's College of Old Westbury. He's the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and has received the George Polk, James Aronson, and John Peter Zenger Awards for his journalism. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the apparent Republican plans to finish off Obama's signature achievement, the Affordable Care Act, if the Supreme Court rules against it.
Jail over dead one. Red rum, political bedlam. Don't let the hype into your eyes and eardrum. Murdoch on Fox, not 18 with Barackas. And he hate Barack cause he marched with the marches. Marches.
I pledge allegiance to the fair and balanced truth. Not the biased truth, not the liar's truth, but the highest truth. I will not be deceived, nor will I believe in the propaganda. I will not fall for the...
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Leek, who is Senior Policy Analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she works on issues related to health reform implementation, specifically health insurance exchanges and private market reforms, including the Affordable Care Act. She's also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and has an article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, New Republican Proposals Would Leave Millions of Uninsured or Underinsured. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Leek.
Thank you very much.
And the piece that you've written is a lot of it is about this fallback position the Republicans appear to have, the Johnson Health Plan, named after the Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. But just to give it some context, Wednesday in the House of Representatives, the head of Health and Human Services, Ms. Burwell, who, of course, is named in the Supreme Court decision, King versus Burwell, she was grilled by Congressman Paul Ryan, and it got sort of testy, the exchange. And it was pretty clear from the grilling that the Republicans will not do what the president recently asked in a speech he made, which is to do the simple thing, which is just to fix this one line in the text that's ambiguous and be done with it. They certainly didn't offer up that possibility and suggested that they have other plans. So is the Johnson plan, you think, the fallback position if the Supreme Court rules against this second bite at the apple they have on Obamacare?
Well, it is the one that has the most support at the moment, at least in the Senate. And there are a lot of ideas floating around out there on the Republican side of the aisle, both in the House and the Senate. But this is the one that has the most support. It has the support of many of the leadership members of the Senate Republicans. So it's certainly one to watch.
So what would it do then? I mean, am I correct in suggesting that there's a sort of cynical calculus here that it'd be a real catastrophe to put 6.4 million people who've gotten health care coverage insurance for the first time, many of them, and just to suddenly take it away from them? I think that's going to create a backlash. There's been some polling done on that. It indicates that that's a very unpopular thing, even with independents and Republicans. It's very unpopular. So my understanding is that they're basically going to sort of fix things cosmetically for those people, the 6.4 million, and extend temporary help to the immediate victims of a possible Supreme Court ruling in return for making sure that there are many millions more who will have no health coverage in the future.
Well, it's really been billed as a plan that would temporarily, you know, delay the disruption that would occur if the Supreme Court strikes down the subsidies in the states with federal exchanges. But as you say, the plan does far more than that. This bill would bar new enrollees in subsidies in all states from getting these subsidies. So that would include the state-based insurance exchanges in places like California that nobody expects would be affected by a Supreme Court decision in King that invalidates subsidies in federal exchange states. So it's really shutting out a lot of people that haven't enrolled yet or people that would move in and out of different types of coverage over time. So it's really closing closing down subsidies for lots of people and undermining some of the key components of the health insurance reform law, such as the requirement that most people get coverage or pay a penalty. That's one of the key things. That's part of the law to try to get healthy people into the system. So if you eliminate subsidies for new enrollees and you say that people don't have to have coverage, then you're going to see very substantial premium increases, and that's going to unravel the whole plan over time.
So do you think that there's any way that the Republicans can avoid the fact that it's manifestly clear that they've been obsessed with trying to kill this from day one? I think they've passed 56 resolutions in the House to kill it. Every Republican appointed judge that's had the hands on the case ruled against it. The Democrats kept it going. We know that this Chief Justice kept it going, but four of the Supreme Court justices voted against it, and it took four Supreme Court justices to bring King v. Burwell to the Supreme Court. So presumably they are the same four, and it's quite possible that this time around that they'll get a majority. Although most legal scholars say the case is pretty bogus. So, do you think there's any way that they can in any way pretend that they really care about preserving anything to do with Obamacare, which they vilified for so long?
As far as Congress is concerned, I think it's no secret that the Republican side of the aisle would like to repeal this bill or get rid of major, important elements of it and do something different. And I think what we're seeing here is various ways. This plan, there's a handful of other plans that have been proposed from different members of Congress about what to do next. And I guess it's sort of unclear what that would be, but it's no secret that the way things are now, which have benefited quite a few people and are going to benefit even more people over time if they're allowed to continue, that would all go away under pretty much any of these plans.
And it's pretty clear that the Democrats have not put forth a plan, right? It's almost as if they're daring the Supreme Court to destroy Obamacare. I can understand why, because as far as the president's concerned and the Democrats who voted for it, it's working. In fact, the president made it very clear in a press conference at the G7 meeting recently in Bavaria that it is working, and he went on to say that the Supreme Court should never have taken this case up in the first place.
Well, I think that the hope of anybody in Washington here who wants the health care reform law to continue and for people to continue to be able to get access to coverage and to be able to get access to subsidies that help them afford that coverage and afford the medical care that they can get under their plans, I think all of us would like to see the Supreme Court not strike down the subsidies in the federal exchange dates. And I think that's the first thing everyone's watching, obviously, in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll have that answer one way or the other. And as far as what to do if it goes the wrong way, there's going to be a lot of things that would have to be done. And, Congress, the states, the federal government, I think everybody would have to do some serious thinking.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Leake, who's a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she works on issues related to health reform implementation, specifically health insurance exchanges and private market reforms included in the Affordable Care Act. And she's also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and has an article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, New Republican Proposal Would Leave Millions Uninsured or Underinsured. Now, it's pretty clear, though, isn't it, that the state exchanges and the attempt in this literal reading of what many have argued is essentially a typo, that there wasn't an intention not to have federal exchanges, only state exchanges, and they are trying to sort of drive a truck through that couple of words in a thousands of pages of a bill that's clearly designed to do otherwise. They're trying to suggest that that was the intention to only have state exchanges. But the reason that they had the federal exchanges as a fallback is that all of these Republican governors refused to set up these state exchanges. And as far as I can tell, they did it for ideological reasons. Do you have any evidence otherwise?
I mean, I think that anybody who was around at the time the bill was getting worked on in Congress, people from various political perspectives, you know, nobody thought that only those that were created by a state would be able to deliver people subsidies. So that's definitely the way that I see it. And I think the question now is going to be to wait and see what the court does, and hopefully it'll go the right way.
Well, what did you make from the exchange in the House of Representatives yesterday between Representative Paul Ryan, the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, when he was grilling Sylvia Burwell, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, over what the administration would do if a majority of justices were to rule in favor of the plaintiffs in this case?
Well, I didn't see the whole exchange myself. I only read the news reports. But my understanding is the administration's just been taking the position that, you know, their powers are fairly limited if the King case goes the wrong way, and, you know, that Congress and the states would have to pick up the pieces if that happens, if the subsidies are eliminated in those states. So, you know, and the other thing they said was, as to this Johnson bill in the Senate that we were talking about, it's akin to a repeal, and that's the way I happen to see it, too. It's by unraveling key components of the law and rolling back benefit protections and getting rid of the individual mandate and stopping subsidies for new enrollees come into the system from other sources of coverage or who've been uninsured. It really just it cuts the legs out from under this law.
But if we didn't have this polarized and dysfunctional Congress, and we were operating, say, as the country used to do decades ago, not many decades ago, even, you know, relatively recently, and throughout most of its history, there hasn't been this kind of poisonous trench warfare that's going on. I mean, in a reasonable world, the remedy would be for Congress to pass a one-sentence amendment to clarify the tax credits should be available to all states. But from what I could tell from the hearing yesterday, Representative Ryan made it clear that they won't do that. Instead, they're sort of dangling out this possibility of an off-ramp or transitional assistance to those that would be immediately affected. But in order to do that, Ryan suggested that Obama would have to accept some compromises. And that to me, is where they're going to drive an express train through it. That's where the Johnson bill comes in.
Right. I mean, I think if you'd asked me 5 years ago when the law was enacted, if we'd still be debating it, you know, however controversial it was at that time, I didn't think we'd still be fighting over it this many years later. But here we are. And I guess, you know, the opponents of the bill are continuing to try to undo it with anything that they can. And the Supreme Court case, either way that it goes, frankly, is something they're hoping to use as a catalyst to kind of move their vision of the future forward. And I just think that whatever plan you would pick up that's come from the opponents of the ACA, it just creates tremendous disruption. And we've gone through a tremendous amount of transition already as people move into these new exchanges and are able to get subsidies and get coverage. And, you know, people made changes in their lives, people made decisions about the future, and to go back and undo things now and throw that onto chaos, I think, you know, a politician has to ask himself some serious questions about whether that's the right way to go.
But what's your sense then? I went to Washington to cover the hearings themselves and talked to a lot of people, most of whom were really obviously actively opposed to it. And, you know, I've been getting a lot of analysis about it from lawyers and legal scholars. And most people think that this is pretty ridiculous. And as the president said at the G7 the other day, it should never have gotten to the Supreme Court. That seems to be the consensus. And people are kind of mystified as to how it could have gotten there. But we've already had a precedent where an obscure petition to the Supreme Court, known as Citizens United, was blown up into a tectonic ruling that has changed the entire landscape of campaign finance. So it's not inconceivable that there could be an overreach in this decision, even though on the first time around, effectively, the Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts saved it. But my feeling is, and this is only my own sort of instincts telling me, that Obama made that statement at the G7 and then followed it up a day later in a speech in Washington to a Catholic healthcare group, where he made a passionate speech about defending the Affordable Care Act and warning about the consequences, and basically saying that everything that's been happening to it has been crazy and unnecessary, and you know, just why are they doing this? I mean, it was pretty strong stuff. So my feeling is that maybe Obama is preparing the country for the worst possible ruling that could happen. Is what do you think?
Well, all I can say is everybody's keenly interested in trying to, you know, find out what's going to happen with this case. And I think that the Supreme Court is probably the only building in this town that doesn't leak. So we're all going to have to wait and be in suspense a little bit longer. I can't say what was in the president's head when he was making those statements in recent days, but I think what I take away from what I've been hearing from the administration is that this is a really serious threat. And if this goes for the plaintiffs in the King case and the subsidies are eliminated in federal exchange states, it's just huge harm to lots of people. And it's hard to know how the different players here are going to be able to pick up the pieces from that sort of wreckage.
Well, it is. I mean, I don't believe that they've sold this thing ever well or properly from day one. And I don't think that Democrats have prepared the country sufficiently for this negative outcome if it does come to pass. So but it may ironically end up being a major campaign issue for the Democrats in 2016. So I guess it's all... you know, you're right. You can't speculate on the Supreme Court. It's the only place that keeps its secrets. The ruling's already come down, so we know what the somebody knows what the ruling is.
Someone knows the answer. That's right. It's just
exactly.
Unfortunately, not us.
Not us. So, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Leake, who is a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she works on issues related to healthcare reform implementation, specifically health insurance exchanges and private market reforms included in the Affordable Care Act. And she's also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and has an article at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, New Republican Proposal Would Leave Millions Uninsured or Underinsured. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into, we'll have co-author of a new strategic analysis, Fiscal Austerity, Dollar Appreciation and Maldistribution Will Derail the U.S. Economy. So we're looking ahead at what is undermining our otherwise healthy economy.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me...
Hey, Pa, get ready to call. Just like Humpty Dumpty, I'm going to fall, and I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along, yes, rolling along. Don't want any million, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, just one, that's all I can wear. A bundle of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who's the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified before Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress, was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress, and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Council Subcouncil on Capital Allocation. He was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences and is the co-author of a new report at the Levy Economics Institute, Fiscal Austerity, Dollar Appreciation and Maldistribution Will Derail the U.S. Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
And this strategic analysis that you have co-authored, Fiscal Austerity, Dollar Appreciation, and Maldistribution Will Derail the U.S. Economy, is an alarming document, and it's very sad to think that, at least to my mind, so much of what is wrong with the U.S. economy, and as you pointed out, is going to get worse, is, I think, because of our politics. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with the U.S. economy, but if you compare it to what the Chinese political leaders are doing, investing in infrastructure and education, while our politicians, many of whom are anti-government and the Tea Party caucus seems to run the Republican Party, they seem to be in thrall with the billionaires that fund them and are essentially hollering out the country, not taking advantage of record low interest rates that you could invest in infrastructure, and just ignoring, you know, Amtrak trains that are crashing, test scores, students' debt, you name it. So I know I'm on a bit of a rant here, but...
I think, first of all, it is regretful to say bad things about the American economy, because, as you know, one of the major indicators of how the performance of an economy is doing is its unemployment rate. And as we see, the unemployment rate has come down, much lower even than the target rate that the Federal Reserve has had set before it embarked on quantitative easing. However, all is not well with the American economy. As you correctly pointed out, there are some significant problems, and I think those need to be addressed. And they're more political. They're sort of the result of political decisions as opposed to actually the fundamentals of the American economy. If one is to look, for instance, this kind of recovery, which is now in seventh year, we'll see that, and compare it with the previous recoveries, we'll see that it's a much shallower recovery. The recoveries, the previous recoveries had reached their pre-crisis level, pre-recession levels, much faster than this recovery has. And it has a lot to do with a number of reasons. First is the transformational change of the American economy vis-a-vis the labor market. That is, the employment, the labor force participation has been declining. And therefore, even though we can say that we have a lower unemployment rate, it may be for the wrong reasons. Also, if one is to look at the components of the GDP, the real GDP, we'll see that most of the components actually are down in comparison, again, with the previous recoveries, whether this is consumption, this is public investment, or even private investment. Certainly, there is some good things. I think net exports are higher, and that has to do primarily with the new sort of oil and petroleum products and also petroleum, and that is because of the new methodology of extracting oil, which, if one is to see only the economic benefits and forget the environmental concerns, which may be significant, that will derail sort of the benefits that one will get from this new methodology, then one has to figure out why is it that the American economy is not doing much better and comparable to China or to even Europe, in Germany specifically I'm talking about, than actually it should, since the fundamentals are significantly better than those in China and those in Germany. And it has to do really with political decisions. You know, the fiscal austerity, which is really the mantra of the Republican Party. And since we have a Republican-controlled Congress, one should expect that sort of the European austerity method is going to continue under the guise of reducing the debt and reducing the deficits. And that's a problem. So I think that this report, principally, wants to bring this issue to the fore because I think it's important for the long-term growth and performance of the U.S. economy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified before the Senate and House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Council's Subcouncil on Capital Allocation, and was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, and is the co-author of a new report at the Levy Economics Institute, Fiscal Austerity, Dollar Appreciation, and Maldistribution Will Derail the U.S. Economy. And we're discussing this new strategic analysis. Now, when you say the recovery, of course, we're not even talking about the 2008 crash, but in its aftermath, we know there was an inadequate stimulus package that was essentially sabotaged by political opposition. And all the way, it seems that we have this strange and dysfunctional government. Maybe it's not unique to the advanced economies, but it seems like every step forward, we take a step backwards, that there's this constant attrition underway. And as you point out, austerity under the name of the sky is falling because of deficits, absolutely hamstringing us to this day. And I just wonder, I mean, when you, the only part of the government, for example, that collects money, the IRS, the House in its new budget have just cut $840 million from its budget. So where is the logic here? I mean, it seems like the anti-government dogma has gotten out of hand.
Unfortunately, there is no logic. You know, this is actually an economic science that resembles more of religion, as opposed to actually economic fundamentals. We all know that unless investments are made, the growth trend of an economy is going to actually decline. And therefore, you do not expect that the only private investment is going to do the trick, and that the reliance on the private sector and the markets and federal markets actually are going to have establish a balanced growth and full employment. We know that only public investment will actually attract private investment. There are certain things that the private sector is not going to undertake. We would not expect the private sector to undertake infrastructure expenditures. This is actually absolutely required in order to increase productivity of the private investment in the private sector. And as we know, the higher the decreases are for either will be infrastructure or even more importantly in basic research, which is really something that America was really the leader, because we were exporting higher technology products, and now we are not necessarily are at the level to say that we could maintain that leadership position. I think that we will be overtaken by China, and perhaps will be overtaken by Germany at some time in the future. So not thinking for the future, but just looking at a very short-term result, which is to cut the taxes, to make a smaller government, so that following sort of the Reagan-Thatcher idea of the government being in the way, it's absolutely the wrong thing. It has been proven so. In every recession, we know that only the government can pull the economy out of the recession. And in our particular case, the $787 billion was not sufficient. It was only 5% of GDP, as opposed to China, the Chinese fiscal stimulus was more than 10%. So why is it that somehow the GOP believes that cutting taxes, especially on the higher end of the income distribution, will actually pull the economy out of a growth trend, which is more anemic than actually it should be and much lower than its potential output?
Well, the only explanation that appears to be out there is that they don't want Obama to have any kind of success. So they're willing to punish the American people and to delay the recovery in order to score political points. I mean, that's at least the conventional wisdom.
No, this is a myopic view, because if we are to look at the experience, we will see that during, for instance, the Bush administration, we have had much higher deficits than we now have. I mean, Mr. President Obama has been on a declining deficit trend which actually is the wrong thing to do, especially from a Democratic president. But nevertheless, you're absolutely correct that it is actually sabotaging how well an administration could do, irrespective of this, of its political spectrum. And my expectation is that should a Republican president succeed Mr. Obama, we will see a much more fiscal stimulus under the guise of either increases in the Pentagon expenses or other things that have nothing to do really with the growth fundamentals of the economy.
Well, in there, sorry, I'm just going to say, in the new budget, as you know, Senator Patty Murray and Minority Leader Harry Reid basically said that unless we can deal with the sequestration deal and resume the deal that, or, you know, reinvent the deal that Patty Murray made a few years back with Paul Ryan to actually spread the pain of this sequester, which, by the way, I think is a perfect example of our political dysfunction. The idea was to make something so dreadful to neither the Democrats or the Republicans would want to accept it. And yet here we have it. And now we're talking about a possible government shutdown in September. And the deal was that you'd have equal cuts in sequestration from non-defense and defense. But the Republicans have found a way to funnel $100 billion into phony Pentagon accounts in order to keep throwing money at the Pentagon while starving the rest of the budget.
I understand. You know, this is really absurd what is happening, especially as you correctly pointed out, that even the Democratic side actually will go along with the Republican nonsense without also recognizing that, you know, even though America has perhaps has gotten better in terms of its current account deficit, it isn't something that one can be assured of it, because as we see, the dollar appreciation ultimately will have an impact, dramatic impact, of our net exports, which are a source of growth. And let alone the fact that we have a maldistribution of income where we expect the lower end of the distribution to actually do the spending as opposed to higher level distribution. So clearly, this is goes against what is sound economics and what one would expect the administration and Congress to be able to recognize and take the appropriate steps so that put the economy on the road to growth and real recovery, not actually the recovery that is basically is anemic. And therefore, it seems to me that unless we find some leadership, spectacular leadership, which of course comes in short supply, I think we are in for some surprises in the near future.
So what happened then to the kind of idea that the Republican Party was the party of the businessmen, the Chamber of Commerce? I mean, even a reactionary like Henry Ford understood that you had to pay your workers enough to buy the product. And you just pointed out that somehow this economy is expected to survive, and it's still something like 70% depends upon consumption, with only the poor and middle class buying goods. Obviously, the wealthy, the 1% alone, can't keep the economy going in terms of consumption. They can't have 100 Rolls Royces in their driveways. They only can drive one car at a time. You know, it seems like that kind of traditional common sense has gone out the window. And I don't know what their new ideology is and what it's based on.
Well, you know, we have basically been accustomed now in the transformation of the American system from what used to be the industrial capitalism to money manager capitalism. So the financialization has actually given us an opportunity to say that, well, growth could come really from activities that are not necessarily productive activities, even though they're profiting activities. And therefore, the question then is, why invest in manufacturing? Why invest in science if, in fact, you could have the profit rate to continue and the aggregate profits to actually be at an all-time high? We know that businesses do not invest. They actually use all the excess funds that they have either to purchase their stock so that the stock can increase in value, or to basically try to show that their companies are worth the investment of their shareholders. and also, of course, to give the rate of profit that is high enough so that the management could actually enjoy the benefits of increased compensation. So I think that there has been a transformation. The private interests are extremely strong, as we can see that who is funding really the Republican Party, individuals who actually have a lot to gain, who with a smaller government as opposed to a large government. And the large government is really associated with more of the Democratic side that wishes to provide for the middle class, a lifeline for the middle class. We see that there has been an erosion of the middle class. Wages have been stagnating, and that everybody knows. It isn't something that, they're hidden in the statistics. Everybody talks about it, and somehow or other it falls on deaf ears when it comes to the Republican Party, but even to some extent to the Democrats.
But in the long term, is an economy sustainable if, with the increasing financialization of the economy, we have a situation where instead of creating wealth, you're extracting wealth?
I'm afraid that you're right. That is exactly what is happening. And as we have tried to point out in our report, by running some simulation for the future, that there are some difficulties ahead, whether it will be the continuous sort of appreciation of the dollar, or would it be actually our dependence on exports that come as a result of increased growth from our trading partners, which, as we know from the IMF, the statistics are not that encouraging. And if you take all this together, what we see in the future is that there may be some difficulties that we may actually, if we're dependent again on consumption to be the primary motor of an economy, which is also dependent, consumption dependent of the middle and lower class, it isn't going to happen. It did happen in the 1990s, in the early 2000s, and we saw that we had a crisis and a meltdown, and I'm not sure that we can afford to do this anymore. So I hope that reasonable heads come to a conclusion that things must change. The new administration, because I don't think anything will happen in the current administration, since usually it is a lame duck administration as it is for the next 2 years, I would hope that cooler heads will prevail.
Well, Dmitry Papadimitriou, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dmitry Papadimitriou, who's the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified before Senate and House of Representative Committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Subcouncil on Capital Allocation and was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences and is the co-author of a new report at the Levy Economics Institute, Fiscal Austerity, Dollar Appreciation, and Maldistribution Will Derail the U.S. Economy. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.